The Superior Court Judge Carl W. Morris ruled on March 31st that the Oakland ordinance permitting the forfeiting of a car after the owner had purchased bogus marijuana from an undercover cop was excessive and, quote, grossly disproportionate under the Eighth Amendment. He instead imposed a $2,500 fine on the car owner and ordered the city to return the car once the fine is paid. The ruling, though local, should set a standard for other cities with similar draconian forfeiture ordinances like New York, says Brenda Grandland of Mill Valley, a leading forfeiture attorney who represented the car owner. Maybe it will inject some reasonableness into the hysteria of local cities having their own forfeiture ordinances motivated by greed. This is Good News on Two Fronts by Peter Gorman, Forfeiture Update in High Witness News and High Times. August 2000. For more information, contact Forfeiture Endangers American Rights FEAR website, www.fear.org. So, that's an interesting article in High Times, and we have another one. Rudy's Reefer Madness: Cops Kill Unarmed Man in New York Pot Crackdown. Patrick Dorismond, a 26-year-old security guard, stopped into the Wakamba Lounge on 8th Avenue for an after-work drink on March 16th. As he was leaving, three raggedly dressed undercover cops approached him and asked if he was selling any smoke. Dorismond said no. The cops repeated their request and allegedly began to bully him with animal noises. A scuffle ensued. Backup cop Anthony Vasquez rushed to the scene, pulled his gun, and fatally shot Dorismond in the chest. The killing exemplified everything wrong with New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani's approach to street-level narcotics policing and set off a new storm of protests concerning the long-running furor over police brutality to the mayor's crackdown on pot smokers. 3 weeks before, the four cops who shot African immigrant Amadou Diallo 19 times had been acquitted. Days later, undercover cops interrupted recess in a Brooklyn schoolyard, chasing a suspected pot dealer with their guns drawn. It is high time that police brutality and killing must cease, especially of black youth, said Umar, a dreadlocked demonstrator in an April 5th protest. Pot busts increased sevenfold during Giuliani's first 5 years in office, rising to one out of every nine arrests in the city in 1998. They stayed high in 1999, no pun intended, with 33,000 busts for smoking in public alone, and last January the mayor launched Operation Condor, a crackdown on drugs and public drinking. It produced over 21,000 arrests in 2 months, three-fourths for misdemeanor and violations. It also produced two unarmed black men killed by police. Dorismond and Malcolm Ferguson, a heroin addict and small-time dealer, shot in the head at point-blank range in the Bronx on March 1st. Giuliani immediately released Dorismond's arrest record, including his sealed juvenile record. He'd been busted once for pot and pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct twice, once after an incident where he'd punched an acquaintance who'd taken $15 to buy pot and only brought back a nickel. The mayor declared that Dorismond had spent, quote, a good deal of his adult life, unquote, using drugs and punching people. The mayor did not mention that Detective Vasquez had once been disciplined for pulling his gun in a bar brawl that he had started, and that his wife had filed a domestic violence complaint against him. Police met the protest with a typical show of force when about 800 people, mostly young blacks, marched from Union Square to City Hall on April 5th. Over 200 officers in riot gear guarded the already fortified City Hall. Dozens of police motorcycles, vans, paddy wagons, and three-wheeled Cushmans accompanied the demonstration, while two helicopters hovered overhead. For an April 20th march across the Brooklyn Bridge, police estimated that there were 3,000 cops and 2,500 demonstrators. Giuliani officials defended the war on pot smokers. Police spokeswoman Marilyn Mode told the Daily News that in 1992, when there were 720 arrests for public pot smoking, there were also 1,995 murders and 626,000 felony complaints in the city. In 1999, there were only 667 murders and 300,000 felony complaints. Marijuana Reform Party activist Tom Leighton last year described Giuliani's philosophy as a drift net approach, that it's better for 20 innocent people or pot smokers to spend 2 days in jail than for one hardcore felon to walk the streets with a warrant out on him. Operation Condor has also encompassed arrests for trespassing on the grounds that anyone inside a housing project to visit a friend is probably a burglar, and truancy. With more than four-fifths of the people busted for pot non-white, Some observers, such as Deborah Small of the Linsmith Center, suspect that Giuliani's war on marijuana is intended to keep young black and Latin men off the streets, where middle-class whites often perceive their very presence as a potential mugging. That may be a valid point, as Giuliani has built his political career on the issue of crime and rarely drew more than 10% of the vote in black neighborhoods in his three mayoral campaigns. The victims of police excesses, searches, petty busts, and shootings are overwhelmingly non-white. The mayor's white supporters often call this a reasonable price to pay for the drop in crime. There's also a little article in this paper on the Santa Cruz solution, nonprofit medical pot. Don't know if it's worth reading. Michael Rotkin is quoted extensively, which is one reason I don't want to read it. Got to say, though, Michael Rotkin has agreed to come back on the air and talk with us, though he hasn't shown up yet. We tentatively slated him for this show, but then because of the possible appearance of psychiatric ombudsperson George Cavallo, we put it off. And also, I frankly would much rather talk to Catherine Byers and Michael Rotkin, because Byers has been pretending to be a liberal for so long. I guess Rotkin also has, but Rotkin, no one believes Rotkin anymore. I guess fewer and fewer people are believing Byers. But anyway, he isn't on this show. He may be coming on a future show. And of course, if anybody's listening who is on the city council and wishes to give their own perspective on the issue, you're invited to call in 427-3772. And in fact, if you're not on city council, we also invite you to call in. Here's a story by Ashley Kennedy, Florida Journey for Justice. Cops drag accident victim out of hospital for one joint. Tallahassee, Florida, the 160-mile Journey for Justice march reached the state capitol lawn here March 30th after one protester was hit by a car and then snatched from his hospital bed by police. The caravan of approximately 30 patients, activists, rollerblading photojournalists, and a float of a jail cell began its pilgrimage for prison reform at the Stark Penitentiary near Gainesville, where an inmate was beaten to death by guards in July 1999. They rolled along for 6 days, drumming and protesting at every prison along their rural path. "If there's no victim, there's no crime. Why are these women doing time?" they chanted outside the women's prison here. A few women could be seen waving white towels from inside. Police stopped the group at least a dozen times. Florida law enforcement has been the meanest of the three states the journey has traveled through, but the support of the people was just as consistent, says Kay Grandma Lee, who organized previous Journeys for Justice in Ohio and Wisconsin. In Sewanee County, they slipped into a motel parking lot to elude police roadblocks and dogs. "The next morning," says Lee, "the cops converged on us in the motel lot, telling us we were not going on through their county." In Madison County, one man had just walked out of the courthouse after flipping off the prosecutor over a marijuana plea when we appeared, recalled Florida activist Jody James. He cried when he saw the proud marijuana smokers. It was exciting and empowering. But in Tallahassee, on the last night of the march, Ray Barry Krieger, a glaucoma patient from Ohio who also has epilepsy, was seriously injured when he suffered a petit mal seizure while crossing a dark, wet road and was hit by a car. "There was a lot of blood from a head wound," says Kay Lee. "Both of his legs were broken." Police had other concerns. "Officer Knight came to the scene, staring at us with hate-filled eyes, snatching Ray's bag," says Lee. Knight claimed he, quote, "smelled a strong odor of marijuana, found a roach in Krieger's backpack, and a joint in his boot." Krieger required 33 clamps in his head, a cast on one leg, and surgery on the other. When police came to arrest him the next morning, one had tears in his eyes and begged his supervisor over the phone to not make him arrest Krieger. His catheter was removed, and police took him to the county jail on a stretcher. The next morning, the appalled prosecutor expressed disbelief over the arrest, and the judge released Krieger without bail. "This is a spiritual journey for me, because I believe marijuana truly is a gift from God," explains Tiffany Landreth, a medical marijuana user who suffers from arachnoiditis. Is that sensitivity to spiders, perhaps? That's from High Witness News by Ashley Kennedy, Florida Journey for Justice. Cops drag accident victim out of hospital for one joint, in the August issue, current issue on the stands of High Times. Here is another story. Wow, there are lots of stories in this month's High Times. I recommend them. I'm going to, however, read a little bit about AB 1800, because I know some of you out there have joined the show or turned on the radio and tuned to our station in hopes of getting some kind of information on that. And what have I got? I've got articles from Dendron magazine, which some of you may subscribe to and some of you may not. Dendron has some interesting articles. One's on Mother Jones magazine investigating the drug company funding of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. 18 drug firms gave NAMI a total of $11.72 million between 1996 and mid-1999. One of NAMI's key core goals is to bring NAMI's PACT, P-A-C-T, which is Program of Assertive Community Treatment. And that, I believe, is like outpatient, involuntary outpatient commitment is what that's all about. I'll read a little bit about that. While PACT has some features clients likes, PACT has an emphasis on medication compliance. For instance, PACT at times includes daily at-home psychiatric drug deliveries to people's doorsteps and living rooms, backed up by court orders. PACT acts as the enforcement arm of involuntary outpatient commitment. PACT workers frequently will visit clients' homes daily to stand and watch as clients take their daily dose involuntarily in their own living room. To see animated photos of PACT dose drops from the PACT training video, see Support Coalition's website, www.mindfreedom.org, and click on Campaigns. Nearly every major psychiatric survivor and mental health consumer organization with a position on PACT outright opposes it. PACT inherently violates human rights values. Support Coalition members are fighting PACT as if our lives and liberty are at stake. They are. So that's from the article NAMI, The Story Behind the Story. That's National Association of the Mentally Ill by David Oakes in the issue of Dendron, issue number 43, which is a publication for psychiatric survivors out of Eugene, Oregon. And looking better and better. Here's an interesting. Why forcing psychiatric drugs into your home, which is what involuntary outpatient commitment is, and what apparently AB 1800 is preparing the way for, does. Why is it bad? Well, here's some ideas. There is a lack of desirable voluntary-based, community-based services. And I read some of this. These are some of the talking points critical of outpatient commitment that were excerpted from position papers published by CARES, the Alliance of Groups in California Fighting AB 1800. CARES stands for Coalition for Advocating for Rights, Empowerment, and Services. To participate in CARES and see the rest of their talking points, go to the website http://homes.arealcity.com/LPS/. If you don't catch all these slashes, call HUFF at 423-4833, 423-HUFF, and I will give you that again off air. The lack of voluntary community-based mental health programs is a principal weakness in the current mental health system. Thus, the issue is not one of voluntary versus forcible compliance, but whether there are adequate community services for people to choose. We're talking about, again, a proposed bill that would make it easier for people to be committed against their wills, easier for them to be forcibly drugged, removing many of the protections, very limited protections, people have with so-called Reese hearings. That is to say, the right to have a sort of an administrative hearing before you are forcibly medicated in the hospital in the psychiatric ward. Also, it would give the power to hold you on grounds that are much more vague and open than the current ones of danger to yourself, danger to others, or gravely disabled. And I don't have all my stuff with me here because George Cavallo didn't show up. And, of course, I didn't give him the call at home that he was hoping for. However, that's part of what AB 1800 is, and here's a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. I wanted to tell you that I got a letter from Fred Keeley of the Assembly on AB 1800.
Uh-huh.
And he said that it passed the Assembly by a vote of 53-16. Mm-hmm. And is currently in the Senate Rules Committee.
Do you know when it passed?
I think it was... Well, this letter was June 22nd. I think I remember something about May 31st. It might have passed.
Uh-huh. Now, we're talking, of course, to Jane Kaiser of PERC. And how? What is PERC, anyway, Jane?
Oh, it's Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective.
And you're out there fighting the good fight. Are you in need of large amounts of funding?
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. And how can people reach you if they want to?
Well, my number is 475-7904.
475-7904. People should know, by the way, that if they want more information about AB 1800, they can still call an 800 number, 626-7447, although I don't know if you'll get anybody on the weekend, but you'll get an answering machine, you can leave a message, and they can get back to you. That's the California Network of Mental Health Clients. Any comment on that group?
No.
So, the bad news is it's passed. Do we have any indication that it's going to go to the Senate before?
It is. It's in the Senate Rules Committee.
And is it likely to, what are its prospects there?
Well, since the Assembly passed it 53-16, you know, I don't know. I'm not going to guess, but I was horrified at that number. Fred Keeley said he did vote against it.
Did you talk to him at all?
No, it's just in this letter.
Huh. And how long is the letter? Does it have any more details? Or?
Not really.
Okay. Well, I know that you actually, the dendron I'm reading came from you.
Well, why don't I let you continue reading that? I just had that little update.
Yeah, and please call in if you have any comments or thoughts.
Okay.
And if folks want to reach you for more information, again, the number is
475-7904.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So there actually is a story, and this, again, we're catching the updates from folks who are interested enough to listen to this show, and I want to thank you, Jane, for calling in, who actually have been staying on top of it. I checked the website a couple of days ago. I didn't see anything about it having passed, and I'm kind of taken aback to hear that it has the lower house, the Assembly, and now goes to the State Senate, and I'm not quite sure where it is there, except, I guess, for the Rules Committee is what Jane says. I'm not sure what that means in terms of how much time we have to fight it. But here is a discussion of a February rally. About 300 people from all over California converged in the state capitol on February 28th to rally against AB 1800 carried by State Assemblywoman Helen Thompson. Thompson's bill calls for an expansion of forced psychiatric treatment and outpatient commitment. Many ralliers wore T-shirts or buttons with inverted triangles. Sally Zinman, executive director of the California Network of Mental Health Clients, explained that the triangles symbolized the plight of thousands of people diagnosed with mental disabilities in Nazi Germany who were the first group to be killed by the Nazis.
You're on Free Radio.
Hey, speaking about driving people out, I mean, that's good, but I was wondering if you could dispel a rumor.
Go ahead.
There seems to be a rumor in the about the Dolphin Project.
Yeah.
I guess that's what they're calling it now.
Mm-hmm.
That they're getting ready to crush that by using some of the units, weeding out some of the units because of structural problems.
Well, here's what I hear.
Is that a rumor? Or?
Well, I think what they'd like to do, again, it depends on who you talk to. Now, opinion has gotten a bit divided because some of the information has gotten out that they're not going to be able to put everybody back into the new project once they bulldoze the old buildings.
Because they're targeting they're going for the red tag approach, right?
Well, now that's a good question.
Is that actually going on? Because I heard it, you know, just in passing somebody that's an on-again-off-again activist, you know?
Sure. Actually, the reality is they have not been able to red tag any of these apartments. I mean, if they had a real... complaint for... But you see, what they want to do instead is convince the... kind of rush the tenants into believing that they have to let the inspectors in. Then what they do is they figure out how many people are in. They put out a plan, and they can eminent domain it if they want. They can, with 5 votes on the city council, they can force the purchase of the property.
So make it an occupancy thing?
They call it a blighted area.
So it's an occupancy type?
Well, what it means is that people, as long as they hold tough and don't allow the city to move in and look at the apartments until such time as they get real written guarantees that they can come back, they can probably hold the line. That's the way I look at it.
Well, thanks for clearing that up for me, Robert.
Sure.
But there is the danger, and I say this to the caller and to the community, that there will be a proposal coming to City Council that will allow inspections without complaints. An inspector can just walk by, see a cracked window, and then demand entrance to the building to do his inspection. And in the course of that inspection, the kind of information that the Lee people, the Lee apartment owners and tenants, have refused to give the city and have stopped them from their demolition project at the moment, would be forced on them, and they would be able to get it without the consent of the tenants, and that may be coming up to City Council in the next few months.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, you know, I noticed that because I had a friend that just totally lost his place up in Live Oak.
Uh-huh.
Or not in Live Oak, but in SoCal Village, and he couldn't get an inspector to come out for the life of him. And then when they did come out, he found out that it was worse for him. You know, it's always, why is it always the tenant that suffers from calling out a health inspector, you know?
It seems to me that what we need to do as tenants is what these Residente Unidos people is doing, is they're getting together. In fact, they're going to other apartment buildings and saying, why don't we all join together, citywide, demand renter protection, just eviction control, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Because I like to work with my landlords, you know? I like to see, you know, things go smooth.
Uh-huh.
And I see him doing some stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
Well, then I look at a few other places around, you know, and things are just so beat down, you know?
Right, well, there are good landlords and bad landlords, and the key thing is that all tenants should have protections.
And that's good and bad tenants, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, I like to see things, you know, why are we fighting over this petty shit in the year 2000?
Why, indeed? Why should we have to spend months and months on the right to sleep at night?
Weren't we supposed to have, like, a habitat in space by the year 2000?
Well, you know, they had all kinds of stories for us as kids, right?
Fucking getting nearsighted, Robert.
Yep.
We're getting nearsighted, man.
I'm getting old, man. What can I tell you?
Yeah, we're getting, I mean, as people, I mean, we are getting very nearsighted when issues like where people are going to sleep and... You know, I get people that ask me, like, where's a good place to camp in Santa Cruz if I come over and visit?
Mm-hmm.
And I go, oh, you know. He goes, oh, yeah, you know, Santa Cruz used to be the total camping place, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's not even that anymore. All these people, that's, you know, I can see it thinning out when people realize what the fuck's going on.
I hear you, man.
People don't like that shit when they find that out, you know?
Well, I know you yourself have suffered camping tickets, right?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, I have suffered a camping ticket.
And you got the runaround from old... In fact, yours was the famous case where Judge Danner made his ruling that not just the city is it illegal to sleep, but even in the county if you fall asleep.
Yeah, it did get dismissed. It was one of the ones that got dismissed, though.
Well,
I just had to show up to court a few times.
Right, but there was a $50 fine, right?
No, there was nothing.
Oh, really?
I let it go to warrant. The case was actually dropped.
Interesting.
But what I did is I missed one court date, and they hauled me in for that. So they because the cop had an attitude toward me.
So he gave you time served for the jail.
Yeah, but he took me in on an ORable.
Really?
He knew it was an ORable, and he took me in on it.
Who was the cop?
Oh, that was back in the days of right shortly within the time span of the May 11th protest.
What, the May 22nd protest?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. was in that. Last that year? Was in around that. And they remembered my face, so they were gunning for me from the get-go. But
you got to do plastic surgery, man. I'll give you a mask you can wear. Thank you for calling in.
I did the whole makeover already.
I'll talk to you more.
Right down to my genomes.
All right.
I changed my genetic signature.
Yeah, but you can't change your voice, and I know that voice.
Damn it. All right, Robert. I just had a bend some steam, man, and I found you as the forum.
Okay.
You were out at a good time, man.
No problem.
What is IOC? Involuntary outpatient commitment. Now, here's a magazine that was written over a month or two ago, and here's what they said at that time from Dendron, number 43. The trend in, quote, mental health is for more and more forced psychiatric drugging out in the community. Psychiatric survivors are leading the resistance to stop these laws in the USA, Canada, UK, and elsewhere. 40 states now have an involuntary outpatient commitment, IOC. Outside the US, these laws are often called community treatment orders, CTOs. During a typical IOC, the mental health system obtains a court order mandating that the subject take psychiatric drugs against their expressed wishes while living at home. Just saying no to the psychiatric drug, the subject risks immediate detention and injection. Ever since an IOC law in New York State passed last year, the biggest battle is currently in the state of California. Assemblywoman Helen Thompson has proposed a draconian law, AB 1800, which would make it far easier to hold and commit people for longer periods of time. And AB 1800 would vastly increase the use of involuntary outpatient commitment in California. To enforce IOC orders in some states, mental health teams make daily visits to the subject's home to watch the individual take their dose on their doorstep or in their living room to aid in, quote, medication compliance. You can see color animated photos of such dose drops on Support California's website, www.mindfreedom.org. Click on Campaigns and then PACT. Defenders of IOC claim it is an assisted treatment alternative to locking up more people inside of institutions. However, the harm of institutionalization isn't caused by the bricks, mortar, and bars, but by overwhelming powerlessness, dependence, and human rights violations inherent in such an authoritarian setup. Involuntary outpatient commitment, therefore, never results in less institutionalization. IOC exports the trauma of institutionalization over the hospital walls and out into our cities and towns. Our home is supposed to be our castle, but IOC transmogrifies the private sanctuary of our homes into a back ward and converts our neighborhood into a psychiatric facility. Involuntary outpatient commitment is institutionalization of the entire community. A member of the Coalition on Homelessness of San Francisco cited an interesting report by the San Francisco Police Department, which states that in 1999, only 5% of violent confrontations between police and citizens involved in mentally ill persons. This report, he said, was done by the city and county, which has more commitments, called 5150s in California, than any other city or county in the state. I'm kind of selecting little bits from this. Fighting Involuntary Commitment, Outpatient Commitment in California, interview with Sally Zinman. What is the situation around forced outpatient commitment in California? And Sally says, the issue is expanded forced treatment, including changing the criteria for being committed. New criteria proposed are lack of insight, that is, supposedly not knowing you are mentally ill, or two, you are perceived as a danger to yourself, or three, deteriorating from a former level of functioning. Sounds like Keith Sugar. Carla Jacobs of the Treatment Advocacy Center is the main force behind the California Treatment Advocacy Coalition, TAC, which worked for the last two or three years to push this agenda forward. We knew this was happening. The Los Angeles branch of the National Association for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, and the California Psychiatric Association got many people involved and then came up with a report. E. Fuller Torrey, director of TAC, testified at a hearing for it, so the direction it was moving in was very clear. Their campaign is tied to what they call, in their words, the criminalization of people with mental illness. That is, how many of us were put in jails and prisons? They had statistics about L.A. County Jail. County Jail is the biggest mental hospital in the country. The reason is, according to them, untreated mental illness. You have to force treatment on people, and then everything will get better. The report had 13 recommendations broadening the criteria for commitment to almost no protection for survivors at all. For example, passive danger to self. Person is unable to appreciate or understand and lacks consistent judgment to make informed decisions about his or her treatment would be a criteria for commitment, and so it, quote, likely to experience substantial injury if not provided with timely treatment, unquote, and, quote, substantially deteriorated from former level of functioning, unquote. All these would replace the new kinds of guides, the old guides, which say danger to self, danger to others, or gravely disabled. The time you could be held without a hearing would be increased from 14 days to 28 days. I should say has been increased by the Assembly bill, which passed. Now it has to pass the Senate. It's still not law. Currently, after a 14-day hold, you can be committed for 6 months. They want it to be 1 year. All the hold times are increased and all the safeguards are decreased. The package altogether is just gross. All of these recommendations, expanding commitment criteria, increasing the time you can be held in outpatient commitment, were written into a bill that is now called AB 1800. When the bill was first introduced last year, we had trouble getting into the press conference room. It was locked. That's not supposed to happen. We knocked, and eventually they had to just let us in. Torrey was there, and Jonathan Stanley, main founder of TAC, and of course Carla Jacobs. Ever since then, the steam has been on in terms of changing the commitment laws in California. The first group to take a stand against AB 1800 was the California Network of Mental Health Clients, CNMHC. Then soon after, Protection and Advocacy and California Association of Mental Health Patients Rights Advocate joined us in opposing the bill. Then California Association of Psychosocial Rehabilitation Services joined us. We are all working together in a coalition. I am told that we have had a huge effect, but I am very careful. You never know all the elements that occurred at the same time that could have affected Helen Thompson. Three organizations organized a demonstration last year to which almost 100 people came in the pouring rain. We stuffed the hearing room. I'm told by people I trust that Thompson was shocked and she slowed down the process. She was surprised to see the amount of opposition and also the intensity and passion of it. On February 28, 2000, we held a protest against AB 1800 with approximately 300 people. This is the year it's hitting the fan. The whole mental health community knows about it. Every hearing where the subject was brought up, we showed up. At the first one a year ago, we got outnumbered by the family members, and we decided to be there every time, and we did. Any place there was a hearing, we started out flanking the family members in terms of getting there early and hogging the speakers list. We made it clear we were going to come out and fight. The powers that be are very concerned about maintaining partnerships, and we are too. Passing AB 1800 would be a political bloodbath. The California Institute for Mental Health held forums. They cited research that showed services, not the commitment process, is what makes the difference. In those states that have loosened their commitment criteria, more people are being committed, but it's the same people who used to be voluntary. They're not getting more people or reaching the people they thought they would. They're just involuntarily committing people who were voluntarily committed previously. We didn't find that out. This objective group did. The interviewer, Janet Foner, asks Sally Zinman, what are the key things you're doing now that you think will help you win? Sally Zinman, we are participating in the process that the state has created on every level, negotiating and dialoguing with all the stakeholders. I think that's very important. A collaboration of groups that are opposed to the bill are working to sign additional groups onto our position. We have two strategies. One is to be a part of this process of negotiating with the state, and the other is to keep fighting at the same time. We have to do both. We are visiting legislators. We have a whole action plan that includes media and an action plan packet to hand out to everyone. On the positive side, one legislator introduced AB 34, which was just a service bill, a full array of services. His approach was to say, we have to try services first. We have to see if services work before forcing people to have services that aren't there. The network supported AB 34 and it got passed, but it was really boiled down to a $10 million for a pilot project. We are working on coalitions outside the mental health system, such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the State Independent Living Services System, social workers, etc. We are also researching and updating our position paper. For example, their concept that the current commitment laws are not working has been disproved by a current upward swing in the number of people committed. How do you see things going on in California fitting in with a larger picture nationally? She replies that this is a trend, like a roller coaster going through the country. At the press conference in New York, when they announced that Kendra's law was going to be signed, that's the New York State Involuntary Outpatient Commitment Law, TAC people and others were there and said they were coming to California. Survivors are being stereotyped and scapegoated for the violence in our country. Our opposition has escalated and perpetuated that stereotype for their own purposes. It's a real watershed issue which could turn us back 30 years and undo all the advocacy and civil rights work we've done in that time. It's a real reactionary trend in the country. After this interview, Sally Zinman helped lead a nonviolent counter-protest on March 23rd in Los Angeles. NAMI was holding a rally there and was hoping to win positive media coverage for the Involuntary Outpatient Commitment Bill, AB 1800. But when Sally and other survivors, advocates, and allies held up signs surrounding the NAMI rally, they stole the show. The real advocates succeeded in making sure that the media covered the real story, the intense division NAMI's initiative is causing. And NAMI, again, is the National Association for the Mentally Ill. Again, some more talking points about psychiatric drugs. An effective mental health system incorporates the self-help model. An effective community-based mental health system would also incorporate the self-help model. The essential philosophy of the self-help model is one in which a self-defined group of mental health clients decides its own goals and methods, making all major decisions. The self-help model is not one set model. It can take many forms. Self-help groups can be support groups, independent living programs, drop-in advocacy, independent living service centers, client-run housing, self-supporting businesses, and artistic groups. Some self-help groups stand alone, i.e. they are autonomous and fully independent. Other self-help groups are incorporated as a part of a larger mental health program. Studies analyzing the effectiveness of self-help groups have found that their members experience a dramatic decrease in the number of rehospitalizations and length of hospitalizations. These studies also found an increase in ability to cope with problems and a general increase in feelings of self-esteem. Self-help groups which encourage peer support should be incorporated into an effective mental health policy. And there are many other arguments called the talking points. You can find them on the website homes.arealcity.com/LPS/ plenty of stuff that's obvious to anybody. Forced treatment of non-dangerous persons violates the right to liberty. Protecting individual liberty is a cornerstone American value and is a foundation of our country's Bill of Rights. The Constitution guarantees that a person's liberty and freedom of choice may not be curtailed without compelling reasons. In a landmark decision in 1975, the Supreme Court ruled that there is no constitutional basis for confining such persons involuntarily if they are dangerous to no one and can live safely in freedom. Allowing forced treatment for non-dangerous reasons, including speculation of future deterioration, absent treatment, or a history of refusing treatment, would violate our Constitution. The broken brain theory does not agree with the conventional wisdom or the experience of recovery. Many proponents of expanded forced treatment base their position squarely on the broken brain theory, which argues that mental illness is solely a biological brain disease like Alzheimer's or a stroke, which causes patients to have no insight into their disease. This is in contrast to conventional wisdom exemplified by the National Institute of Mental Health's description of schizophrenia. Quote, "Scientists do not agree on a particular formula that is necessary to produce the disorder. No specific gene has yet been found. No biochemical defect has been proven responsible, and no specific stressful event seems sufficient by itself to produce schizophrenia. Research on recovery defies the broken brain theory. Recent worldwide studies of very long-term outcomes over two decades for schizophrenia, quote, consistently found that half to two-thirds of patients significantly improved or recovered, including some cohorts of very chronic cases. The universal criteria for recovery has been defined as no current signs and symptoms of any mental illness, no current medications, working, relating well to family and friends, integrated into the community, and behaving in such a way as to not being able to detect having ever been hospitalized for any kind of psychiatric problem. Forced medication of non-dangerous persons violates the rights to informed consent and privacy. I mean, that seems... why even expand on that? Involuntary outpatient commitment curtails freedom without reducing violence, hospital readmission rates, or the state's budget. The Supreme Court has held that the nature and duration of commitment must bear some reasonable relation to the purpose for which the individual is committed. Proponents of involuntary outpatient commitment say it will prevent violence, reduce hospital readmission rates, and save money. The reality is that none of these goals will be met. Current law already allows for forced treatment of people who are dangerous to themselves or others. No change in the law is necessary to achieve that goal. In fact, expanding forced treatment will scare many people away from requesting help and drive those who need mental health services underground. Coercion does not lead to less reliance on mental health services. Recent studies show that enhanced voluntary services, not court orders, lead to reduced hospital readmission rates. And forcing non-dangerous people to undergo treatment will not save the state money. Instead, it will increase the taxpayer costs by forcing money to be spent on acquiring court orders and paying for police officers to apprehend and detain people who violate their treatment plans. Expansion of forced treatment will exacerbate the problem of non-compliance. Forced treatment is a reason for non-compliance. Expansion of forced treatment will not stop non-compliance. Studies and countless anecdotal reports indicate that persons who have experienced force avoid treatment in the future. The Well-Being Project, a research project supported by the California Department of Mental Health, found that 55% of clients interviewed who had experienced forced treatment reported that fear of forced treatment caused them to avoid all treatment for psychological or emotional problems. 47% of all the clients who were interviewed reported that fear of forced treatment caused them to avoid treatment altogether. Clearly, the very existence of forced treatment deters people from seeking treatment. Anecdotal information tells us the same thing. Force and coercion ultimately don't work. Many people needing support are walking the streets, homeless, without services, because of their prior experiences with forced treatment and its concomitant disrespect and abusive treatments. More forced treatment is not the answer. A response of some New York consumers to the passage of Kendra's Law, an involuntary outpatient commitment law that expands New York's commitment criteria, has been to develop guidelines for consumers on how to avoid the mental health system. And again, there are more and more and more reasons. Forced treatment is antithetical to therapeutic relationships. Medical noncompliance is a problem endemic to all health fields. I read this actually on Thursday. These are the general categories, and there are a lot of specifics, interesting stats, and a lot of footnotes, which I'm not going to read you. And you can get this information, again, by going to the web, if you are a computer person, and looking up homes.arealcity.com at the HTTP site there. Well, what have we here? We have about another 6 minutes. So any of you who are getting a little bashful and didn't want to call in, but now think you got, maybe you want to say something about the sleeping ban or about police harassment or maybe about this Citizens Police Review Board, this committee meeting that's finally coming up July 17th at 5:30 on Monday, which is a week after the full board meeting on July 10th. Maybe you want to give a quick call in and just say howdy, give us an update report, or maybe you want to come to the ROAR meeting this afternoon. That's Restore Our American Rights. That'll be happening out in the Poganip. Nope, not the Poganip. It'll be happening at the Harvey West, at the intersection of Harvey West Boulevard and Dubois or Du Bois Street. If I'm awake, I'll be there. It looks like I'm beginning to fall asleep. I think I have an interview here that I can actually begin playing.
Weeks later, I'm in jail.
Maybe not. That doesn't look like it's ready yet. I did interview Fred Geiger, and I know that I promised I would play him. I'm not going to have time to play his entire interview. What I think I will do is try to begin the interview and see how far I get. I don't think I'm going to get very far because I think we have that no-holds-barred talk show host Lady Scararms and Baby Greaser James coming in with Cut Your Hair and Get a Fucking Job, and that's at 3 o'clock, and I don't know if I'm going to cross needles with that babe. You know, it's going to be Norse, get out of here, and yesterday. So this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides is probably coming to an abrupt, overextended, end here in about 5 minutes. So maybe I have something shorter I can play you. This is a possibility. We have a little bit of Steve Argue. Again, that's a long one. I could try perhaps singing a... I don't think I'm going to sing anything for you. That would be a cruel and unusual punishment. We have a little something from the last meeting. I think we may be stuck with old Fred after all. Fred's a good man, but I hate to get him involved here without giving him a full opportunity, and this is really a longer tape. So I continue my researches here, trying to find a appropriate... I think we just may have to do that. Maybe a little music might not be a nice way to ease our way out of the station here. Oh dear, it's the afternoon blues, I gotta tell you. Let's give Fred a chance, and what we don't hear from him this time, we'll listen to next time.
Second, 10 o'clock. I wanted to hear you sing.
Now, wait a minute. You interrupted a tape by the inimitable Fred Geiger to hear me sing?
I want to hear you sing.
Well, what kind of... You want to hear the old Homeless song?
How about some punk rock music or something?
Well...
Break up the monotony of your voice for 4 hours as if that wasn't torture enough.
You had me going there. Why don't you give us the update, V-Man, on the radio situation? Anything new coming over the line on tax on free radio across the country?
San Francisco Liberation Radio received a letter in the mail a couple weeks ago. There's actually a protest today up in the Bay Area against Albertsons food stores because of their continued support of corporate radio station KOIT and... not to be confused with the act of coitus or anything, but, they're kind of fucking us over on the airwaves up at KOIT.
So you say people are more fucking, less fucking over.
Huh? Yes. Mm-hmm. And,
A little coitus can't hoit us, you know.
So San Francisco Liberation Radio has targeted one of their largest advertisers, being Albertson's chain food supermarket, and have decided to protest against them and try and convince them to stop supporting this NAB station, KOIT.
Now, what about this crap that's in Washington there, Vinny? You know, we had the situation where the rules, these cheesy, half-assed rules got passed and they got overturned.
Oh, yeah. California was in the first filing window for licenses, and that window has closed at the beginning of June, and all told, over 750 radio station licenses were received for low-power FM radio stations in 14 states and territories. All the states and territories into five groups, and they did a lottery and selected the states at random. California was in that first batch of states and territories, and I think over, out of the total number of 769, I believe was the exact number of applications received around those 14 states and territories, California totaled for about 300 of them. So almost half, a little under half, maybe about a third of the total licenses were filed for in California.
But
only two of them in the county, and both of those in the city of Watsonville. And we have two stations that applied, two groups, I should say, that applied to for construction permits of a low-power radio. And those groups are the Human Rights Committee of Watsonville and Ohana de Watsonville, which I'm not sure what that means.
Now, what kind of restrictions would those who are applying for legal licenses have to operate under?
Well, for example, the two stations in Watsonville that applied, those applications are mutually exclusive because they both applied for the same frequency, and that was 104.7. Not to mention the FCC, when they passed this rulemaking and order establishing the creation of low-power FM radio service, they basically relaxed the third adjacent standard, third adjacent protection standards, and Congress put forth a bill recently and killed that relaxation of that standard. So basically the third adjacent protection is still in place, and so 80% of what the FCC would have licensed in the first place is no longer even going to be considered. And both of those stations in Watsonville most likely will not get a license because there's already an existing radio station at 104.3, and since the Congress basically blocked the FCC's relaxation of the third adjacent channel protection standard, I know this gets kind of technical here, but since they did that, that frequency is no longer available for a low power station.
Well, I have to
cut me short here.
Well, very soon, because two savage broadcasters have arrived.
Oh, thank God.
The vicious...
I thought you'd been on the radio for far too long.
I know. I was just stalling for them to arrive.
Old Lady Scarms, or was it Baby Greaser James? I'm never entirely sure. I'm a little bit confused in my old age here. Have arrived. I'm sorry, what were you saying, Vinny?
It was all a conspiracy to get you off. I was trying to stall you so that they could come in and sneak up on you.
Well, they did successfully, and I'm...
Yes, I was able to kick the door down and subdue Robert. He is currently actually
quite a
totally
piss bottles up on the
prone floor. On the floor here.
Well, we tried a little defecating and urinating because there was no dumpster nearby, but we're going to leave you, and I'm going to leave this station in the hands of, or the arms of,
Old Lady.
Yes.
Wise choice,
yes,
young
I
man.
Agree. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Sorry, folks, for that delay. Robert unfortunately wasn't telling the truth when he said he was going to give the station over easily, and...